The blizzard was thinning enough so that Anya could see back along the trail where figures continued to struggle. One held up a black submachine gun with the side-mounted magazines over his head. Lal, his kukri lost, butt-stroked a gorilla across his bearded face with the Enfield. But the burst of 9mm bullets raked the young man's belly and chest. His uncle barely caught him in time to keep him from falling over the cliff. Flipping his kyber knife to his left hand, Pan grabbed the muzzle brake of his M16 and carried it slung barrel down behind his back. He snapped up the weapon and caught the pistol grip. The storm closed in again. Disregarding the risk of further avalanche, Pan backed along, aiming toward the gorillas. He tucked the knife away in his belt and held the long rifle with both hands. With his pack still strapped to his back, Prasad couldn't take up his stricken nephew into a fireman's carry. Instead, he scooped Lal up in his arms. Anya willed away the sword and threw down her kukri.
Prasad, let me help.
He turned her down with a single emphatic headshake. A shiny tear trail ran down each leathery cheek. Pan turned to climb up the trail as he changed magazines. The unarmed Sherpas had fled up the path as best they could. Anya didn't blame them. Prasad, carrying his nephew, led the way, sure-footed as a mountain goat. Anya unlimbered her own rifle. If the enemy was going to shoot, they couldn't afford to hold fire, avalanches or not. They'd have to take their chances. They weren't good in any case. She walked backward up the trail. No more shots came from behind them. They rounded another bend in the trail. It offered momentary shelter from gunfire in case the pursuers opened up again. Before Anya, Prasad carried his nephew as if he was an infant. Within a couple of hundred yards, they came upon the porters, huddling against the trail's inner face in apparent terror. They were already half covered with new fallen snow. Anya wondered what could have possibly frightened them more than trigger-happy gorillas.
What's that, Pan?
For a moment, Pan didn't answer. His head was held high, goggles still pushed up on his forehead despite the heavily falling snow. He seemed to be looking to far vistas despite the big flakes that clogged his lashes and must have been painful as they collided with his eyeballs. She thought he'd wandered off into history again. He then blinked as if rousing from sound sleep.
I don't know.
He pushed his goggles back in front of his eyes. Uncharacteristically angry, Prasad kicked the Sherpas to their feet.
Get up! Get up!
Bonmanche!
Bonmanche?
Prasad turned his face to her.
It is the Yeti.
They're afraid of it?
Yes. It can be very fierce, but it is also a spirit animal. They fear it is a sign of evil coming.
Anya glanced nervously back down the trail. She could no more see through the falling snow than she could a glass of milk. Below them it seemed twice as dense as ever, although where they stood it fell relatively lightly.
How's Lal?
Prasad only shook his head. Struggling to his feet, one of the porters suddenly froze.
Bonmanche! Bonmanche!
He flung up his arm. Anya looked to where he pointed. Mist swirled like smoke around a shadowy creature. Then the snow descended again.
Bonmanche! Bonmanche!
Prasad had never spared an upward look. Holding his nephew's limp body in his arms, he continued to drive the men to their feet and upward along the narrow cliffside path.
It was just a bear.
It seems pretty high up for a bear.
The procession began to file along, bent beneath the storm as if it doubled their loads. One of the Sherpas had quietly added Prasad's pack to his own. His burden now doubled. Didn't seem to slow him any.
We're still a couple thousand feet under the tree line. Or it could have been a man in a heavy coat.
A very big man.
Stay with me here, Pan. We're not out of danger yet.
I'm sorry, Anya. It's as if I've been awake for days. I find myself drifting off to sleep. But it's the past.
It's a dream. A waking dream. I know you've snapped back when you needed to. But especially with the air so thin, I'm worried you'll fall so deep in the past you won't be able to pull yourself out. Even to help us.
Pan looked at her with a strange light in his dark eyes.
I will never let you down, Anya. No matter what happens, I will stand beside you.
Thank you.
Goggles over her eyes, she walked up beside Prasad.
Can I examine Lal?
Prasad shook his head.
You can do nothing.
It was just so brutal. The burst, completely unaimed and fired from the worst imaginable shooting position, shouldn't have hit anything. It should have spattered across a half acre of mountainside. But somehow at least four, and possibly five, bullets had hit Lal solidly in the torso. There simply wasn't anything to do for him on a perilous mountain trail in a horrific blizzard, with human wolves still pressing behind in unseen pursuit. Pan stopped and turned, bringing up his M16. Anya stopped. She held her rifle pointed back along the trail. She glanced at Pan, who frowned thoughtfully.
What did he say?
Demons in the snow, I think. They're retreating back down the trail.
There's no such thing as demons. The altitude must be affecting them too. Especially Bajraktari's gang. They got jumbled up in the storm and started fighting each other, that's all.
Hurry, please!
Anya didn't ask Prasad why. She and Pan just turned wordlessly and moved out again. Both still held their rifles. Anya truly didn't think the pursuit party was going to be catching up to them anytime soon, but even the relatively light weight of the weapon reassured her. Prasad had led them to the right, up into a cleft in the rock that might have been made by a cleaver. After a sharp climb of maybe 50 yards, they came out between two big rocks to find themselves walking up an easy slope. Anya didn't know how much farther they walked. The wind had lost its edge of fury, as if it had spent itself in the squall that caused the gorillas and bandits to accidentally go for each other's throats. The snowfall gradually diminished. The surroundings became clear, slowly. They were in a valley, with big rocks interspersed with stands of hemlocks. So coated in snow, they might have been snow sculptures, except for the occasional dark branch peeking out. They crossed a saddle of land. Before them, a crevasse 30 yards wide plunged down into the earth as if it wouldn't stop short of the core. A plank bridge hung from thick, hairy ropes crossed it. On the other side, the high stone walls soared, and the steeply pitched, sweeping, eaved roofs of a great monastery were visible, perched like a castle on a crag that stood up out of a cloud bank as if floating. A lama in a red robe sat before Pan and Anya.
I am so sorry. There was nothing we could do for your friend. As learned as our healers are, we have limited resources.
Anya shook her head. Sorrow for the brave and cheerful young man who had done so much to help her would haunt her for a long time. As always, Prasad had refused to accompany them to their interview with the head lama. They left him grieving over his nephew's body. The lamas led the Sherpas to a dormitory to eat and rest.
I don't think he could have survived those wounds, no matter what treatment he got, nor how quickly.
Pan knelt beside her, holding salty, buttered tea.
Nonetheless, we share your sorrow for the loss of your friend.
For a few moments, they sat in silence. Like some of the shrines she had discovered, the room was startlingly colorful. The walls were carved with shapes from Tibetan Buddhist mythology, all brightly painted. Halfway up one high wall ran a balcony. Its thick wooden rails were painted in different colors by one-yard sections, red, green, yellow, blue. Melted butter lamps on twisted black iron stands sent yellow light dancing over all that color. A bell-shaped iron stove sat in one corner, its rusty sides seemingly on the verge of glowing red hot. Looking like a Buddha, with his clean-shaved head and his cheeks spilling straight onto the crimson shoulders of his robe without any sign of a neck, the lama nodded to indicate the moment of silence was over.
I am Toshan. I bid you welcome to the Lamasery of the Winds.
Business pressed. Anya felt almost as reluctant to turn to it as to let go of mourning for Lal. But there was always time for grief.
You speak English very well, Toshan.
Oh, I did not always live on a remote mountaintop, my friends. When I was young, I too traveled the world. Once I visited America. I spent time with relatives who lived in a most magical city.
Which one?
Pittsburgh. Also, we have satellite dish.
For a moment, Anya was unable to do anything more than gape at him, dumbfounded.
I thought this was called the Lost Lamissary.
But it is not lost. We know right where it is. You are here, are you not? No. The proper translation, taking mind of the difference, is Lamissary of the Lost.
Wait, what does that mean exactly? Lost souls?
Well, perhaps found souls would be better. No, not of lost souls. It is a gathering place for those who are lost to this world.
Anya glanced at Pan. He looked distant again, almost as if in a trance. She halfway hoped he was still altitude sick.
But I'm not lost to the world.
Are you not, Anya Crane? You who carried the burden you do? Can you truly belong to the world you knew? The material world of ready explanations it pleases you to call a scientific? Or do you merely cling to that which you have already lost beyond recovery?
Llamas in both saffron and red robes entered, bearing beaten brass trays with colorful, covered ceramic bowls on them.
Now you must sustain your bodies, my friends, that they may adequately house your spirits. That's very important, you know.
The llamas set the bowls between the visitors and Toshan. There were a variety of vegetables in various sauces and white sticky rice. Toshan beckoned his guests to serve themselves. Moving almost like an automaton, Pan served Anya and then himself healthy quantities on oblong plates of scarlet ceramic, painted with mythological beings. The sudden awareness of how ravenously hungry she was drove almost everything else from her mind. Beside her, Pan ate as wolfishly. She had thought the nausea that had roiled incessantly in her stomach all day, another reaction to higher altitude than her system was prepared to handle, would keep her appetite at a minimum, but it made no difference. Toshan watched with apparent satisfaction as his guests ate. Then, with a nod, he graciously permitted red-robed acolytes to heap his own plate high with food.
You are to be congratulated, my friends. You have passed through the four previous lamissaries: earth, stone, water, fire, each named for the element which dominates it. To reach each one, you have faced trials. At each, you received further guidance on your path. We are, as I have told you, wind. Here, you shall receive the final guidance. I warn you, though, that your greatest trials, physical and spiritual, await.
You should know, Toshan, we're being chased by a combination of mouse gorillas and bandits from Kosovo.
Do you take us unaware of this? Ah, my foreign friends, do you think anything passes in this land without our knowing? We have abided here many centuries, while enemies and kingdoms and parties came and went. Do you think isolation alone has served to protect us? Forbidding walls of stone, huh? Those of whom you speak do not threaten us. Only those whom we allow can find this place.
What will keep them out? The demons they claim to attack them in the snow?
Anya felt a twinge, wondering if the real Pan had asked the question. She could as easily imagine his fantasy persona of an ancient general speaking those words.
That's all just suggestibility and altitude sickness.
Perhaps indeed. Maybe we did send demons. Maybe we sent a storm that shielded you and perplexed your foes. Or maybe those impure ones who followed you summoned up demons from within their own souls to torment themselves. Perhaps it is all those things. Or perhaps none.
Anya could only shake her head.
As you see, I know about your quests, my friend. General Pantaras came here on a quest, too. He neared his goals, the one he had set out to reach, and the true greater one.
Will you answer a question for me, Master Toshan?
Please. Just Toshan. Spare me the burden of titles.
All right. Toshan. Why have we found all these clues? Every lamasery we've stopped at has presented us with scraps of transcriptions of a journal written over 2,000 years ago. Hasn't that been awfully convenient?
It is because you were fated to come here.
Anya thought. She showed no reaction.
Oh, I know that you do not believe in fate, Anya Creed, any more than you believe in demons, despite the secret burden you carry. You are simply too polite to tell a fat old man to his face that you believe he is, as you might say, full of it. You believe that only you and those who think as you do see the true face of reality. I can only shake my head sadly and hope that someday you might see this universe of shining gears and ratchets you have constructed is itself merely a glittering toy, an illusion by which you hide the truth from your eyes.
She wanted to say something, whether to dispute him or make some polite evasion, she didn't know. But he held up a chubby finger.
No need exists for us to debate. My universe, like your unseeing, unfeeling, uncaring machine, shall carry on regardless of whether either of us believes or disbelieves. I only caution you for your sake. Do not be too hasty to disbelieve in the help that comes to you in your direst need. You can explain it away later. What is vital to your quest and possibly your survival is that you do not fight it.
I'll do my best.
Of course you will, my child. The clues you speak of were given so that you might be tested. As I say, you have proved worthy. Of course, what you have proved worthy of is nothing more than a final test. Is that not the way of quests?
Toshan held a small brass bell with a blue-painted porcelain handle. A yellow-robed lama entered, carrying a scroll on a tray.
As you no doubt guess, this is yet another transcription from General Pantras' journal.
Pan accepted and carefully unwrapped it. Anya saw with relieved approval that he had pulled on a pair of thin gloves before handling the age-yellowed document. Either he had returned fully to the present, or the habits ingrained by archaeological training and fieldwork transcended space and time. His handsome face grew craggier in his concentration, despite the softening effect of the butter bowl light.
It's short. He says he's been given directions to the cave shrine. He also mentions that the lamas say it is guarded by a hairy, man-like creature. That's all. He doesn't actually repeat the directions.
Anya felt as if her heart had entered freefall. Stricken, she looked to Toshan. He smiled beneficently.
Open your hearts, children, and you shall not leave this lamasery without the knowledge you need to complete your quest.
A young lama in a crimson robe entered and bowed.
You are tired from your travails. Now you will sleep. Zompa will see you to your chamber. Your possessions have been carried there for you.
Throughout, he never stopped beaming at them, as if they were his very favorite niece and nephew. Anya and Pan rose and followed the silent Zonpa. He led them out of the chamber. After walking through the stone hallways lit by torches, up several flights of stairs and along another corridor, Zonpa stopped and bowed them through an open doorway. They entered. It was a simple chamber with windows set high in the walls, illuminated by the inevitable butter lamps. Two pallets had been laid out side by side. Anya's and Pan's gear, rifles included, was stacked to either side. Anya glanced at Pan. Kneeling, Pan went through his gear.
So, our Yeti guards the highest shrine.
What happened to your earlier hard-headed skepticism about Yetis?
I saw one, to start with. So did you.
The visibility was bad. And we were fighting for our lives. It was just a bear, Pan.
It didn't look like any bear I've ever seen. It didn't really look like a man to me either, Anya. Man-like, but not a man. And why do the natives all say the creature exists? They live here.
This altitude is getting to both of us. There's no point debating this.
No doubt you're right, Anya.
She knelt with hands on knees. There was so much she longed to discuss with Pan, but suddenly the whole weight of the day's events seemed to land on her at once. She barely had the energy to unlace and remove her boots and crawl beneath the waiting blankets and furs before she dropped into a deep sleep. Dressed in his black leather greatcoat, Anver Bajraktari stood with his arms folded as his enormous henchman, Duka, plunged an arm into the drift of snow the gorillas had been excavating. The bodyguard was roped to another Kosovar who sat on the trail several yards above with feet braced against a rock. A few yards farther down, past a rugged gray rock, was nothing but air. Pushing with his uninjured leg, Duka heaved. Up came a dark shape encrusted in snow. It was the hood of a furry mountain coat, with a man's head inside. Several of the upcountry gorillas slid down the short slope, their legs raising white swells of snow. They pulled the man Duka had found the rest of the way from the snowbank. As he lay on the slope, one held a canteen to the badly chapped lips, surrounded by a fringe of grizzled stubble, and dribbled water between them. The hood fell back from his head.
Why did you disturb me? Left to my own devices, Jagannatha, I wouldn't have. But it seems you are too much the legend to be allowed to slip peacefully into oblivion, even by my own men.
If it is any consolation, Major, we thought we were recovering your corpse.
Jagannatha looked up at Bajraktari with red eyes. His men helped him to his feet. He shook them off and trudged up to the trail unaided. At once, he was surrounded by his own troops and men in green and black camouflage. Chatura stood to one side, looking sour. Bajraktari moved over beside the commissar.
Don't be downcast, comrade. We lost many men to the avalanche and the storm. This man is a seasoned warrior. We need his courage and his cunning. And afterward, when the treasure is ours, we can give him the rest he desires. Is it not so?
Sunshine shot into Toshan's audience chamber through high windows. Its brightness bleached the colorful carved walls where it touched them. The iron stove cast its warmth.
I regret to say that the Sherpas you brought with you have refused to proceed any further. They have opted to return to their villages.
I don't blame them. We'll carry on as best we can.
Oh, now you are not to be left in the lurch, my young friends. No worries. Prasad has elected to remain with you. He is a good man.
He is.
We have told him we will keep the body of his nephew until his return. Should he not return, we will give the body to you to deliver to his relatives in Banglong. If you do not return, we shall see him home ourselves. As for Sherpas, we have arranged for men from the vicinity to carry such supplies as you will need.
I didn't think there'd be many people up here.
Toshan smiled his world-encompassing smile.
The White Mountain holds many surprises, my friend.
Out in the yard, they found a glum Prasad awaiting them. Anya went to him and hugged him briefly. He endured it stolidly. Pan gripped him on the shoulder. They turned to look over their porters. A half-dozen small, sturdy men in heavy, fur-lined coats with big fur caps looked back at them curiously. To Anya's surprise, each man carried a bolt-action Enfield rifle slung over his shoulder. Toshan came down the monastery steps behind them.
Guns?
Some of the bloodier episodes of the history of Tibetan Buddhism might surprise you, Anya Creed. We are not always men of peace. When the pilgrims face peril from the unrighteous, it is certainly permitted that they defend themselves.
Pilgrims?
I think he means us.
Anya glanced up at Pan. He had his head up and was looking at the great mountain looming above them. In the early morning sun, his expression seemed composed and determined. She looked back at Toshan. The fat monk stood with his plump, bare legs splayed wide.
The shrine lies higher up the mountain, above the tree line. In your heart, you know where to find it.
Anya looked at him in puzzlement, but Pan nodded.
I can find it.
Go with my blessings, then. And an old man's wish that you both attain that which your hearts truly desire.
Thank you, Toshan.
You have done us a great service. What we have done is the least we can do.
She leaned in to kiss his cheek. His skin felt smooth as a baby's. Then she turned and led the way out of the lost lamasery and off across the swaying rope bridge. They found trails along and up the mountainside. They were steep, and snow and ice made the footing treacherous, but the only real difficulty was the thinness of the air. Though they could have used them, neither she nor Panteras had oxygen bottles. Anya pushed her goggles up her forehead. The early spring Himalayan sky was clear, but she knew that everything could change in an eye blink at this time of year. The trail led around the mountain's flank. The path was relatively broad, the slope to their left relatively gentle. She knew that was deceptive. Beyond the edge, it was a long way down. The trail wasn't as gut-churningly terrifying as the ones they'd threaded yesterday, but a moment's inattention could kill her just as dead. Although she felt rested and fit, she knew that was partly illusion. The high-altitude climber's rule was to sleep below 10,000 feet whenever possible. Above that, the air's meager oxygen density challenged the system and made it hard for the body to recover even with rest. The Lamasery of the Winds was at 12,000 feet. She was seeing phantoms. Strange shadow shapes lurked at the corners of her vision. Twice already she had started, turning and preparing to call the sword into her hand, before realizing they were figments cast up by a brain starved of oxygen. This was an unusually well-traveled part of Dalagiri. Yet they'd seen no one the past 2 days but themselves, their pursuers, and the monks. Toshan had told them over breakfast that word of an increase in the violence of the civil unrest was driving tourists off the mountain, and indeed, many out of Nepal itself. As the sun neared its zenith, the leading Sherpa waved his thickly gloved hand, then pointed.
He sees the cave.
Prasad walked bent over, as if he still carried the dead weight of his beloved nephew. In a sense, he did. Anya's heart went out to him. Pan straightened. His gaze was clear as he turned his face up the snow-bright slope toward the nondescript jumble of rocks the excited guide pointed at. Spinning around with her heart hammering, Anya saw, strung out along the slope below, the dark, sinister shapes of the hunters. Prasad signaled to the Sherpas on the trail ahead of them. As Pan unlimbered his own slung Kalashnikov, several Sherpas shed their packs and started fanning out to seek cover with their bolt guns. As more gunfire came from below, Anya realized both Pan and Prasad were looking toward her. Prasad had also dropped his pack. She knew immediately what that signified. This would be the fight that decided all. No bullets came near them, but Anya could see puffs in the snow below them where they fell short.
We should press on. The cave has to be more defensible than being out here on the trail like this.
Prasad nodded instantly. Pan looked at her for a moment. She remembered his promise to fight beside her. She didn't know who had delivered that promise, Sergeant Pan or General Panteras. Pan nodded crisply. As the men who had taken up blocking positions on their back trail held off their enemy, Anya led the rest upward as fast as she dared go. Prasad pointed just as they reached the switchback.
Look!
Following his outstretched hand, Anya looked up the valley. Her heart sank. Like a volcano's deadly flow, a white mass streamed down the glacier.
The storm will be on us in minutes.
It will help us. In the snow, they cannot shoot at a distance. If we have a good defensive position, they will lose the advantage of numbers.
Anya nodded. But as she started up the next stage, the gunfire increased. But she couldn't see whom her men were shooting at. Pan touched her arm.
There it is.
She looked up the slope. 40 yards above and to their left, a sliver of shadow showed dark beneath the slab that crowned the rock outcrop their point man had indicated.
Without waiting for instructions, Prasad began to forge straight toward it, angling to avoid the sheer drop that fell from a little ledge before the cave. Anya and Pan followed toward the deep snow. To her left, a Sherpa dropped forward. Only a hole marked the spot where he fell in the snow. Anya's heart was already laboring. She looked back. There were four men who had positioned themselves as rear guard. Two of them leaped to their feet, spinning to point their rifles uphill. A hand clamped her arm, and Pan pulled her toward the cave.
Come on!
But we have to help them!
We cannot! Juggernaut has flanked them! They're caught in the kill zone!
Then the other two men fell. Anya turned and raced for the cave. Running through the snow was like trying to run along the bottom of a swimming pool, but even harder. She forced her way onward against weight and resistance. As she neared the beckoning darkness of the cave mouth, Anya's legs gave way beneath her. Pan seized her from the left. Prasad stepped over to help, and the two men hauled her up and carried her the last few yards. When they reached the snow-covered stone ledge in front of the cave, they laid her down carefully. Then they dropped to their knees. Without being fully aware of doing it, Anya found the metal-shod plastic butt of her rifle, pulled it tightly to her shoulder, the iron sight swimming before her eyes. Figures trudged up the mountain toward her, shockingly close. Some were small and carried submachine guns. Others carried broken-nosed AKs. Anya laid the front sight on one of the taller forms. She switched to the nearest target to her left. It was one of the Maoists. Anya's world had narrowed to a sort of white tunnel with out-of-focus figures beyond. Only vague stirrings of motions at the fringes of her tunnel vision alerted her to more targets. She felt neither fear nor fatigue. She felt nothing at all. There was only deep breathing meditation, the meditation of death. Hands hauled her up until she got her boots beneath her. She stood and spun, then staggered into the cave under her own power. Her small, brave party was already mostly gone. Inside, the cave was still cold, but felt almost hot after the chill of the wind outside. It was dark. A greenish glow sprang from Pan's lightstick. The cave was smaller than Anya expected. There was no question it was artificial. The walls were flush, polished, smooth, and shiny. It was also empty. Anya felt herself sag.
Get them out!
Dropping his lightstick, Pan spun, rifle at his hip. The muzzle flash filled the tiny cave with angry, jittering orange glare. A waist-high bank of blue smoke, stinking of burned propellants and lubricants, filled the cave. So did the copper smell of blood. Prasad darted to the entrance, aiming his own Kalashnikov. Prasad reeled back into the cave. Anya saw small holes, deceptively neat, in the front of his coat. A grenade bounced toward Anya. She stared at it as if it was a serpent in mid-strike. For once, she was frozen in indecision. Prasad fielded it one-handed like a major league shortstop. He jammed it to his chest, folded his arms over it, and rushed outside. Brilliant hellfire flashes danced in the cave mouth as Pan's body hit hers. Pan climbed painfully to his feet. Picking up his rifle from where he'd dropped it, he went cautiously to the cave entrance and stuck his head out for a 3-second look. Then he stepped outside. Anya sat up, her head spun. She felt numbed horror at Prasad's self-sacrifice. For a moment, she couldn't bring herself to budge. To her enormous relief, Pan quickly returned to kneel at her side.
They've pulled back. We should check out the cave.
She nodded. He rose and extended a hand to help her. She shook her head and pushed off with her hands. She swayed, had to get a knee beneath her. Finally, she got upright. Since Pan had stuck his head out into the daylight, Anya's eyes were better adjusted to the dark than his. She quickly found a second crack that, from the proper angle, turned out to be a 4-foot-wide tunnel angling into the rock of the mountain. From where they had been, it was completely invisible. They shared a look,
then cautiously entered the passageway. Anya held her M16 in one hand and a small flashlight in the other. Ahead of them, the tunnel, which, like the cave, was either wholly artificial or natural but improved, curved right. As they crept around the bend, they saw a yellow glow. Pan moved in front of Anya, rifle at the ready. She followed close behind, holding the flashlight up over his shoulder and making sure to keep the muzzle of her weapon covering his back. A few feet beyond the tunnel, a wide, smooth-walled chamber opened. Pan advanced into it. At once, he sidestepped left, by policeman's reflex, clearing the area where any hypothetical waiting enemy would have a perfect shot at him. Anya followed, quickly stepping right. Then she let herself take in her surroundings. By the light of butter lamps, she saw treasure. Gold coins, silver ingots, jewels, glittering idols, all covered the floor. Overflowing crates were stacked high up the walls. A path through the center of the room led to a jovial golden Buddha statue, at least twice life-size, sitting in lotus position in an alcove in the far wall. Before his crossed legs rose a stone catafalque. Upon it rested the perfectly preserved body of a man in full Macedonian armor. Aside from his full beard, which was black lined with silver, he was a perfect match for the man who stood beside her. As if in a trance, Pan walked slowly forward. A sword in a scabbard of what appeared to be leather that was as well preserved as the dead man lay across a bronze breastplate molded to resemble a heavily muscled torso. The bronze itself was still a deep yellow-red color, not the green of verdigris. A large oval shield stood propped against the stone bier by his feet. Its polished face was silver, its sheen dulled, but not discolored or severely tarnished. Pan picked up the sword and drew it from the sheath by its gilded hilt. It was a Xiphos, the characteristic Macedonian sword, with a straight, double-edged blade about 2 feet long. Yellow light from the improbably burning lamps reflected across Pan's face from the shining blade, illuminating a look of sheer reverence as he turned it in his hands. Pan pitched forward across the corpse. Too shocked to feel, Anya spun. A man built like a short bear with a tattered and bloody coat stood at the treasure chamber's entrance. Half his face was burned black, and his left eye was invisible behind a crust of baked and congealed blood. His unscorched cheek bristled with a graying stubble of beard. In his right hand, he held an ungainly pistol with a short box magazine in front of the trigger and a long, slender barrel. It was Major Jagannatha. His terribly disfigured face was a mask of conflicting passions. Anya was astonished to see what she could only take for grief predominate.
I'm sorry, but it must be this way. I cannot let you tell the world of this.
Anya felt as cold as the glacier in the valley below.
So you'll let Chatura plunder it instead?
No. I'll die first. But before that, I shall kill him.
The numbness of seeing her companion, her friend, unexpectedly gunned down before her, began to fade. Emotion began to seep in around the edges of Anya's being.
You're right about one thing. You will die.
The sword's sudden appearance and the ferocity of Anya's lunge made Jagannatha flinch. His aim was off. Pain lanced through Anya's left thigh like a white-hot iron. The leg gave way beneath her. Jagannatha danced back. Her anger kept growing, driving her on. She forced the leg to work, and she ran into him. They grappled as her momentum pushed him back. She bounced him backward off the walls. They battered and clawed ineffectually at one another. Their battle carried them into the cave's outer chamber. Jagannatha managed to bring a knee up hard. Anya's grip weakened. He pulled away and raised the handgun. He fought to control the swinging of the muzzle enough to get a shot into Anya. Taking a two-handed grip on her sword, she wound up.
The mystic blade struck his gun arm 2 inches above the wrist. As he raised the bleeding arm before his face in horrified disbelief, she sidekicked him, and he stumbled out the cave's mouth. In grief and pain and fury, Anya collapsed on the cave floor. The cold stone sucked the warmth from her body. Somehow she didn't mind. She felt as if she should just let go, allow her life to flow from her, and merge with the stone of the great white mountain. But that was not her way. She refused to give in or give up. Full of pain, she crawled forward and disengaged the auto pistol from Jagannatha's lost hand. She was going to need all the firepower she could get. She no longer had any reasonable hope of escape. She was alone on the mountain. All her friends and allies were dead. But she was coldly determined to take as many of her tormentors with her as possible. Chatura stood on the trail with hands on hips.
So, the mighty Jagannatha still lives.
Anver Bajraktari and Duka stood right behind him. The gorilla chieftain lay bent across a boulder 10 feet beneath the ledge of the cave, his arm bleeding in fitful pulses. Though his chest continued to rise and fall, his spine was clearly broken. The storm had subsided for the moment. The wind was almost still, and only flat flakes fell slowly upon his shattered body.
We'll have to remedy that.
Bajraktari was woozy with more than altitude and exertion. They were down to fewer than 20 men. Almost as many lay strewed along the trail, and especially around the cave mouth. The pursuit had been nothing but disaster piling upon disaster. Only a mad rage for revenge, combined with an even more insane lust for the gold that must await them within that cave, had kept the group from breaking and fleeing back down the mountain. There couldn't be many living enemies inside the cave with that terrible witch woman. She might even be alone. All the same, by now, Bajraktari felt they'd need every man they had to force their way inside and overcome her. Duka looked at him. Jagannatha had fought like a hero, but he was no use to them now. Bajraktari looked his henchman in the eye and shrugged. Although he still favored his right leg in its brace, Duka disregarded the sheer drop. He slithered out toward Jagannatha. When he reached the gorilla leader, he picked him up and flung him unceremoniously over the cliff. Bajraktari stood watching the dark, spread-eagled shape dwindle beneath them. When it fell out of sight, he turned his dark eyes up to the mouth of the cave. Chatura brandished his auto pistol.
What are you waiting for? Seize the cave in the people's name!
Reluctantly, the men began to advance along the barely visible wisp of trail toward the cave's dark mouth. Anya threw aside the M16 and pulled Jagannatha's gun from her belt. She then went to the entrance. A Kosovar loomed in front of her. Leaning around the entrance, she aimed at her attackers. At least 2 went down before a wild fusillade from a half-dozen automatic weapons drove her back into the cave. She aimed at the first 2 men who came in after her. The pistol's magazine was empty, and any spare magazines had gone down the mountain with Jagannatha. Falling back, Anya dropped the useless weapon. A shadow blocked the entrance. She recognized the vast, ungainly shape of Duka. He entered with Bajraktari right behind him. The Kosovar chieftain looked at her with his living eye as cold as his dead one.
Take her. Very well, then. Shoot her.
Duka raised a scorpion machine pistol. Something spun past Anya. She felt its breeze of passage puff against her sweat-drenched cheek. In wonder, Duka looked down at the golden hilt of the ancient Zephos buried in his chest. Then he toppled forward. Bajraktari gaped at his fallen henchman. He tried to raise his gun. Anya was already gliding toward him like an avenging fury.
You lose!
Bajraktari's dark eye stared at her in agonized disbelief. She yanked the heavy auto pistol from his hand. Despite the pain, she raised her wounded leg, put the sole of her boot against his chest, and pushed hard. and he went over the edge. To free fall 1,000 feet with his guts streaming from his body. The pain the exertion shot through her leg brought Anya to tears and robbed her of her strength. Her legs buckled beneath her. A strong arm caught her from behind as she fell. She looked up. Pan held her. He was dressed in the full armor from the dead man on the bier. Still supporting her, he stooped to yank his sword out of the dead Kosovar's chest. She stared at him.
How?
He only smiled down at her. Her vision faded. She sagged. He steadied her until she could stand on her own again. Then he took up the silver shield he had carried in with him. In a moment, the enemy was on them again. The three surviving Kosovars charged in. But they were cut down before their eyes adjusted to the cave gloom. Anya and Pan moved to stand to either side of the entrance. Gorillas rushed in with submachine guns. The defenders slashed them down from behind. Then came four of Jagannatha's men, kukris in their hands and vengeance in their eyes. Ignoring the agony of her wounded leg, Anya fought in a whirlwind. Pan fought with controlled fury, blocking deftly with his shield. His Zephos licked out like a frozen steel flame. Dead men lay heaped at their feet. The floor ran slick with blood. Strength deserted Anya. Pan caught her again. He pressed his mouth to hers. They shared a passionate kiss. Then consciousness left her, and Anya slid into black. When she awoke, Anya was alone, except for the dead. Using her elbows, she dragged herself to the cave entrance. The storm was about to hit again. The first hard-driven flakes of snow struck Anya's cheek like grit. Coming up the path below, she saw a fresh squad of Maoist guerrillas, trudging bent over into the wind with their submachine guns held across their chests. A small figure slipped from hiding among the rocks to join them. Anya was flooded with anger. The man was Chatura, the district commissioner for Antiquities Division. He was the one behind all her troubles, the man guilty of the deaths of her friends. He had set her up from the very outset. Chatura gestured up at the cave. Anya grabbed a submachine gun dropped by a fallen foe. Those that weren't hit went to their bellies and aimed toward the mouth of the cave. The flames from their muzzles were like small bonfires in the fading light. She lashed the flame sources with bullets until the curved magazine emptied. Then she slithered back far enough to find another weapon and fight on. The snow closed in like a white wave sweeping over the face of the mountain. The last weapon Anya could reach without going back into the cave and giving her enemies a chance to rush her ran dry. Frustrated and filled with fury, she retreated. Exhausted by blood loss and altitude, she collapsed against a wall of the small cave.
It's not fair. We won.
Any more enemies simply made a mockery of it all, of Pan's sacrifice. If he was still alive, she might have retired to the treasure room and made a last stand there, but she didn't have the strength anymore. It felt as if her bones were melting within her. Through the white blizzard curtain that covered the cave mouth, Chatura stepped, grinning. He aimed his handgun at her.
You have given me a very great deal of trouble, Miss Creed. I am about to shoot you in the belly. I don't want to kill you right away, you see. I mean to disable you and allow my men to take their revenge on you for the deaths of their comrades.
Anya gathered the last threads of her strength for a death leap as she curled her hand to summon the sword.
No!
Frowning in puzzlement, Chatura started to turn. He was yanked backward out into the storm. Through a scrim of falling snow, Anya saw in silhouette a huge form holding the struggling man aloft. Chatura was tossed to his death. The creature then turned on the other gunman. A heartbeat later, Anya saw gorillas hurled past the cave mouth and over the cliff, following their treacherous leader to destruction. She could hold on no more. Oblivion claimed her. Anya sat with Rue at a sidewalk cafe. It was 3 weeks after the desperate fight for the cave shrine, and her wounds had mostly healed. A gentle spring morning breeze made the streets of downtown Delhi almost bearable.
It was a bear. What else could it possibly have been?
Uncharacteristically, Rue said nothing.
Next thing I knew, I woke up in the treasure room next to Pan with my wounds all bandaged. I got lucky. The Mauser bullet was copper jacketed, not pure lead, so it didn't deform much when it hit me. It passed through my leg cleanly, missed the bone. The doctors here say it didn't do any lasting muscle or nerve damage.
Which Pan? One or two?
Anya fought back tears. She was determined not to let her guard down with her sometime mentor.
I don't know. Even though it's up above the tree line, somebody must live up there. Or at least somebody visits the shrine regularly, tends it. Somebody has to keep those butter lamps filled and burning. They must have found me and bandaged me.
Indeed.
I didn't hang around after I woke up. For one thing, I was still desperately weak. For another, I was half crazy from hunger. I used an M16 as a crutch and somehow made my way back down to the Lamasery of the Winds. I have no idea how long it took. I really don't remember anything about the trip, which is probably for the best. The lamas helped patch me back together. Whatever treatment they gave me seems to have worked really well. They also got a message out by satellite link to the Japan Buddhist Federation. It took a whole week before I was back on my feet.
Rue looked indecently cool, composed, and somehow superior. A hint of a knowing smile played around his full lips. She practically felt his unspoken question. It had nagged her, too.
I don't have any idea how Pan did it. He must not have died at once from Jagannatha's gunshot after all. He somehow got the armor off his counterpart, put it on, and came to help me fight one last time.
The truth is so plain, yet you refuse even to consider it.
And that would be what?
Rue set down his cup and sat back, gesturing grandly.
Why, what else? That your savior was the long-dead General Pantaras himself, the great champion. The hero who chose to become eternal guardian to the treasure he had been sent to steal. In the last extremity, he rose up from his sleep of millennia to carry out his task. Your Pan's sacrifice must have given him the strength.
You're right.
You mean for once you agree with me?
Not about Pan. I mean, you're right, I won't consider that.
And I suppose you're also in denial that the one who finished off your attackers in the storm and the one who ministered to you and laid you beside your Pan were one and the same. Who but the famous Yeti, the other guardian of the Golden Buddha?
Yep, I sure do deny that. It was obviously an angry bear that killed Chatura and the rest, and it was pilgrims who tended to me. Nothing else makes sense.
Ah, your precious rationality. Which means so much more to you than truth.
He picked up his cup on its saucer again.
Well, I hate to add to your sorrows by bearing bad news, but I must.
What bad news?
The team the Japan Buddhist Federation sent to secure the highest shrine claims they found no cave.
But I gave them the GPS coordinates. I kept track of every step we took.
Nevertheless, that is what they claim.
Anya fell back against the uncomfortable back of her white-painted metal chair. Her whole world had suddenly imploded. All that sacrifice and sorrow and loss was for nothing. She believed she had failed. To make matters worse, she had undoubtedly deep-sixed her own credibility. If the JBF didn't believe her story, she'd be lucky to hang on to her job at Chasing History's Monsters, to say nothing of the grim fact that she would certainly lose both her standing in the academic community and even the chance of continuing employment as an undercover archaeologist. Rue sat studying her face. Then he smiled.
While it's a shocking, cynical lie that every cloud possesses a silver lining...
Rue reached inside his coat.
This one, as it happens, does.
He produced an envelope. He handed it over. Inside was a check from the Japan Buddhist Federation.
Not only are the JBF paying off on your full contract, they've thrown in a healthy bonus. They also prefer to maintain complete discretion about the whole affair. Insofar as they are concerned, you have successfully carried out your assignment of surveying and cataloging a number of historical shrines in Nepal. Nothing else happened.
Why?
How would I know? Am I a Buddhist? Or Japanese?
Rue held up a hand to forestall an angry verbal assault.
Peace, woman. If I had to form a guess, and no doubt I do to keep you from flying at my eyes like a harpy, I should guess that a guilty conscience can sometimes pry open the tightest purse.
And in the end, it was still all for nothing. Except maybe...
Except?
She raised her face hopefully.
Maybe Pan found the prize he was really seeking all his life, as his namesake before him did. Peace?
Without much interest, Rue shrugged.
As to that, you and I will never know. But come, you must still have your GPS unit with the coordinates saved. As the saying goes, the ball is in your court, yes?
From the inside pocket of the light jacket she wore, she took her GPS. She recalled the cave's coordinates. For a moment, she sat looking at the display. Tears fuzzed out her vision. She blinked them away.
Farewell, Panteras Catramadas.
She pressed clear.
Rogue Angel, Seeker's Curse is a graphic audio production. Rogue Angel trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2009, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Christopher Sheeran, Jonathan Watkins, Joe Brack, Thomas Penny, Mort Shelby, Scott McCormick, Danny Gavigan, Chris Rowan, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, and Michael John Casey. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Dan Smith and Matt Webb. Book adapted for graphic audio by Josh Cristiano. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Vada's War. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Falcon, Mrs. Custer told me something that I'd never heard before. She told me that you were with her husband when he was killed.
I wasn't with him at the exact time he was killed. I was with Bentine and Reno when the general was killed.
Why haven't I heard this about you before?
Because my being there was an accident of sorts. A lot of good men gave their last full measure of devotion on that day. I never felt it was right to detract from their honor by interjecting myself.
I wonder, Falcon, would you share the story with me now?
It's been over 50 years, and I've never told this story to anyone before. I'm not sure I can do it justice. Well, I warn you, it's a long story.
I'm a novelist, Falcon. I deal in long stories. Please, go ahead.
Well now, the year 1876 was what historians would call an eventful year. In Philadelphia, they celebrated our country's centennial. Colorado became a state. They invented the telephone. And at a lonely place in Montana, General Custer and 265 brave men were killed.
Colonel McAllister, this way! Damn! You're one hell of an engine fighter, Falcon. I've been at this game for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
The Colorado Home Guard is missing 100 rifles. It looks like we just found a few of them.
You mean in addition to the Gatling guns we're looking for, there's also a bunch of repeating rifles out there?
Sweet fancy Moses, look at that.
Have you ever seen that many Indians at one time?
No, sir, I have not. Two Bears was right. These engines is coming from everywhere.
We have to tell Custer about this. I don't think he has any idea what he's letting himself in for.
You don't really know the General all that well, do you?
I haven't known him very long. Why do you ask?
Because it ain't gonna make no never mind what we tell him. He has his mind made up to go after the engines, and that's exactly what he's gonna do.
We've got them this time! We've got them, boys! Trumpeter Martin!
Don't miss the saga of Falcon McAllister at the Little Bighorn in Eagles 14, Bloodshed of Eagles. Available now in graphic audio.
In a land where no good deed goes unpunished, Frank Morgan, the last gunfighter, is in for a lot of punishment.
Come on, let's go see about this.
Breaking.
If that was one of your parts, I'm afraid they crossed the divide, fella. One shot up real bad in front of the cabin. The other still inside.
I'm called Roof. Roof Blake.
Anybody you'd like for me to write to?
You mean to tell him I'm dead?
Just in case.
My ma and sister who live in Flagstaff. Ma's name is Alma Blake. My sister is Tess. I got wages coming from the Lazy F spread owned by Howard Flynn.
I'll see to it that your ma and sister get what's coming to you, Roof. Don't you worry.
Hold your fire, mister. We just want to find out if our parts are all right.
Come ahead. But keep your hands where I can see them.
That looks like a couple of our friends.
One's Roof Blake. The other's called Bragan. That's all I know about him. Wardell's still in the cabin.
What happened here?
I rode up and found the cabin on fire and those men lying out here. They'd been shot as they ran outside.
He's lying, Buxton. I bet a hat he's the one who killed them boys.
Morgan's in for punishment and a lot of headaches.
I don't normally wear a badge.
Yeah, before, though. So it ain't like I'm asking you to do something you've never done.
I'm on my way to Phoenix. I've been mixed up in enough shooting scrapes in my life.
I can see why you feel that way. But the plain fact of the matter is, we need you here, Frank.
Punishment, headaches, and Frank Morgan ends up with a target on his back.
Shit!
Morgan! It's Frank Morgan! He's their leader! Get him!
Frank Morgan.
That's my name. What business is it of yours, mister?
Just making a note of it. I like to keep track of these things.
What things?
Oh, just the men I've killed.
Saddle up for William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter, number 14, The Devil's Legion, in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.